Then I understand that Sir Selman Cohen want to comment on that, but before I maybe remind you of time that...
Why don't you go on? I'll make a comment. I can make a comment later.
I mean, it's okay. Just like you want?
Well, I'm entirely in your head.
Well, then I'll leave it to you.
Yeah. I think before we have to do... I just want to say a word about privacy. As Mr. Morgan said, my own view is a different view. My own view is a view that privacy ought to be protected statutorily and not left to the Press Council. And as Mr. Morgan said, there is currently a private member's bill which won't make way because it is a private member's bill at the present time, and he draws attention to the drafting of that bill, which attempts to define privacy, and of course it's a very difficult thing to do. We know it when we see it, in a sense. And the draft that he referred to appeared in an earlier draft of a bill, which at the end of the 1960s, which was a decade when there was a good deal of concern about privacy. I think that there's a very serious implication in the argument that privacy, this is the British argument, that privacy should be left to the Press Council and should not be made a matter for the courts. Mr. Morgan referred to the committee which dealt with this matter pretty comprehensively in the early 1970s. And what this committee said was that privacy was too impalpable. When you came to think about it, it was too impalpable. And if you are going to protect privacy with statutory remedy, and statutory remedy would sound obviously in damages, you would leave an area of uncertainty around the whole thing which would operate as an unhealthy limitation and an uncertain limitation upon the press. Of course, it was always contemplated that in determining whether there was an intrusion on privacy, there should be a defense that what was published was in the public interest. And there was always the public interest, as opposed to interest to the public, there was always the public interest as a defense. Now, the Younger Committee rejected the notion of a statutory protection of privacy on the ground that it imposed an unreasonable and uncertain restraint upon the press. But it said, and went on at great length to say, that it was highly appropriate for the Press Council to do it. And in fact, they made some recommendations about the amendment of the structure of the Press Council so that it could the more appropriately and the more effectively do this. And this has been the Press Council's position since that time. And indeed, there was a third Royal Commission on the Press in 1977, which said that they were concerned with intrusions upon privacy and they would like to recommend a statutory protection of privacy if they could, but they felt that they still couldn't get enough certainty into it, and it was better that it should be left to the Press Council. Now, Mr. Morgan has drawn attention to the definition of privacy, the statutory definition in the bill that is presently proposed for the British Parliament. And that statutory definition of privacy, in fact, is the same, or substantially the same statutory provision as was suggested in 1969. Now, of course, you could do it another way. You could make the definition of privacy what the Press Council itself has done in its own declaration on privacy in 1976. And it's that declaration that the press has to live with. And I think that that in itself is a definition of such generality that it could subsume all of these things that are referred to in the bill to which he's referred. Now, the important point, and the point that worries me, is the following. You start by saying that if you give statutory protection to privacy, you impose an undue fetter upon the press. You make the way of the press too uncertain. Each time you've got to decide, was there an intrusion upon privacy? And if so, was it an unjustifiable intrusion having regard to the public interest? But that's precisely the same question precisely the question that the press council has to grapple with in the experience of the cases in which I've sat as chairman. And inevitably, it's the same thing. So that whether it be a court which is facing the issue of privacy in the context of a statutory remedy, or the press council in the context of a press council ethical obligation, the issues that the press council or the court has to grapple with are the same issue. One, is this an area which falls within the notions of privacy? And secondly, the very, very hard question, and they are hard questions, is there a public interest in the publication? Now, it's no different from a court, from a press council, if you like, of 36 or 37 people. No different. Now, if there is a suggestion that it's appropriate for one and it's not appropriate for the other, if there's a suggestion that it's appropriate for the press council but not appropriate for the court, it says something about the public view of a press council remedy. Because while a press council remedy doesn't sound in damages, doesn't sound in coercion, a press council remedy says it is unethical to do it. And it ought to operate as precisely as rigid a constraint upon the press as is an award of damages. And I have gone through this again and again and again. And it seems to me that there is an implication that somehow there's something softer edged in a press council statement, you mustn't do it, you shouldn't do it, you're censured for doing it in certain cases, and a court's judgment that this sounds in damages worth X thousand pounds or rubles or what you will. And I find that a very worrying notion, and I find it a notion that I can't understand. The final point I would want to make, and I do apologize for the length of this, is that in the Third Royal Commission on the Press, there is a chapter which deals with the Press Council and which deals also with privacy. And it says this, and I've tried to read it from left to right and from right to left to see if I can get better understanding by doing it in the Hebraic way. It says that if there were a statutory remedy for privacy, it would derogate from the jurisdiction of the Press Council, and that would be in some way damaging to the Press Council. Now, I cannot understand that, or if I can, I think it's a bad doctrine. Because I do not see how in the evolution of time there is objection in saying that in certain cases a statutory remedy may be appropriate so that that may subtract from the jurisdiction of the Press Council. In fact, it won't necessarily subtract from the jurisdiction of the Press Council because the Press Council may in such a case provide a Press Council remedy rather than a person going to law. A person may still take his choice as he takes his choice within the area of defamation, subject to press council waivers. But the notion that somehow or other a reduction in press council jurisdiction does damage to the press council, I think misconceives the whole notion of the press council. The press council is not there to preserve and to expand a jurisdiction necessarily. A press council may contemplate a reduction of its jurisdiction with not only with complacency, but with full agreement. The real issue in each case is whether a remedy should be appropriately available in law or not. And for the reasons that I've attempted to adumbrate to you, and I'm afraid Great Britain has taken a great deal of time over this with the two of us, I find it very difficult to understand the present stance of the Press Council on this, and I find it very difficult to understand the position that has been developed not only by the Press Council but by what was a very serious and very powerful committee on privacy, the committee to which we've referred. Thank you.
Well, it's exactly 1 hour left of the program and five speeches, which means nobody must use more than 12 minutes. I'll be very strict on that. Mr. Felice Maselli from Italy, please.
I must begin by saying that I owe a few apologies. I owe an apology for you for not presenting in time my written portion. I did not even know what the topic was until I left. So I jotted down some notes of something that is of dramatic interest to us in Italy currently. It borders upon privacy. It's not quite an issue in Italy as it is elsewhere, from what I understand here. What we have in Italy right now is something very, very important for us, and I would like to share this with you. I am speaking, of course, on behalf of the Order of Journalists, and right now there is a debate at several levels within several organizations on two vital aspects of journalism: the right to inform and the right to be informed. Now, all constitutions talk about that. I'm sure that there is not one country in this man's world which by constitution, no matter how totalitarian or democratic you are, will spell out there is a right to inform, there is a right to be informed. Then when you come down to the nuts and bolts of it, it becomes a totally different manner. Let me begin by pointing out that within the Order of Giornalisti in Italy, we have four operational commissions. The first one is the Cultural Commission for international relations and, however, relations even within Italy with other organizations. The Administrative Commission, for administration purposes, of course. The Recourse Commission, that discusses complaints against journalists and so on. And finally, the Juridical Committee, whose task it is to prepare opinions and proposals for the Italian Parliament for some laws that somehow affect journalists or may infringe upon the freedom of information. The issue of debate currently in Italy is the protection of sources of information. We call that the segreto professionale. Let me start with a short preamble. The protection of sources of information as we see it is essential for the freedom to inform and, of course, for the right to be informed. Lack of this protection would jeopardize the principle of these rights. It is not a privilege, it is a right for the journalist. Having to reveal the source of information would be quite detrimental to the profession of the journalist in the present and in the future. In the present, because he is betraying his source of information, and in the future, because he will lose that source or any other source of information because he is losing credibility. And yet, by Italian law, a journalist may be forced to reveal the source of information. And if he refuses, he may be imprisoned. And this is currently going on in a few instances right now in Italy. What is the matter of the contrast? The contrast is in the two separate laws and their different chronology. The younger one is the law of the Order of Journalists, and at Article 2 of that order, we did spell out the journalist's right to protect, or however not to reveal, his source of information, unless the source authorizes him to do so. But then by the same token, in Article 351 of the Italian Penal Code, the journalists are excluded from the right of professional secret, segreto professionale. Who has it? In Italy, the physicians have it, the lawyers have it, the assistant physicians have it, and of course, the clergymen. They can accept anything in confession, but then by the same token, they cannot reveal the source of information. Is it a limitation? We believe it is. It is a great limitation. To the extent, as I told you, that even recently we have journalists imprisoned or just relieved from prison because of this contrast between their own law, our own law, and the government law, the state law. It's a political problem. And only a law bill can balance this contrast. And that is exactly what we are doing. We are preparing to review our law of the Order of Journalists because it is only some 20 years old, and nevertheless, it is starting to show its age. And then by the same token, as we look at our own, we must look into others that infringe upon or are marginal upon our activity. Some of the proposals: to include the journalists in the list of professional categories who have the right to abstain from bearing witness, or however, the right not to reveal their source. Another proposal could be that to recognize the journalist's right to protect the privacy of the sources of information as granted by law to law enforcement officials. In other words, in Italy, law enforcement officials, the police, and so on, do have this authority. A third solution can be to recognize to the journalists that they cannot be prosecuted if they decide to avail themselves of this right. All of this has not too much to do with privacy, as I told you. Again, I apologize. Our presentation was not quite prepared for that, but for this, which, as I said, is quite dramatic for us because it is now being discussed. For your own information, the Constitutional Court has also asked the Italian Chamber of Deputies to prepare their own proposals, to take another look at Law 351, to consider Law 2 of the Order of Journalists, and somehow come out with a law that will balance the needs of one and the other. Therefore, we as Order of Journalists are not looking for changes to our article, of course, but we are requesting the magistrates to look better into to Law 351. Another important thing for us, and here is privacy, but the privacy of the reporters, the journalists, is to impound the documents. Very recently, two reporters from two very well-known newspapers. One was La Repubblica, published all over Italy, and the other one was a local newspaper in Sicily. The two reporters had access to some information in the court, which evidently had been given to them, with some purpose evidently, but the information was given to them. They printed the information, and when asked by the judge to reveal the source, they refused, and therefore they spent a few days in prison. The Order of Journalists and our federation, two separate entities, immediately brought the matter to the attention with a protest, to the attention of the parliament, and soon they were relieved. The fact still is that the two laws are in contrast. We consider the piece of information not to be a notizia criminis, but it offers only the opportunity to satisfy the right to inform, and also the responsibility of the journalist to further delve into information through his own sources to ascertain the facts and to enable himself to be fully responsible for what he is saying, for what he is publishing. The privacy. And here I am going to talk a little on my own because I do owe you something on the privacy. As I said, it is not quite that dramatic in Italy. Whoever in Italy feels that his privacy has been infringed upon will not come to the Order of Journalists to complain. That matter is taken directly to the court. The court may take action, and this is where the ethical side of the Order of Journalists comes in. If we feel that, as a matter of fact, the ethics of the profession, to include privacy, have been infringed upon by poor handling of information, even while the case is being discussed or even studied by the court, we, the Order of Journalists, may suspend our reporter from any future activity until such time as a sentence is issued, which may free him, in which case we too free him, or free him, of course, from the responsibility and authorize him to return to his activity. Or if the court action is against him, then we have our own juridical commission study the matter to see to what extent the journalist is wrong and therefore must be considered responsible, to what extent there may be infringement upon our freedom to inform by the state action or the court action. And I believe that's it.
From Norway, Gunnar Bodal Johansen, Secretary of Press Council.
I'm sorry that we have not prepared a paper for this session, but I will try to answer a couple of questions we have come up with during the first session. And I think my chairman will fill in afterwards if he feels so. The right to information is protected by paragraph 100 in the Norwegian Constitution, which says that every man and woman has a right to express any kind of information without any public censorship. But we feel today that the protection by the Constitution is not so strong as it should be. We therefore feel that we need the particular Freedom of the Press Act, which the Swedish got as early as 1766. As you maybe know, we all very often look to Sweden. The press organizations have placed the topic at the political agenda and have been supported by people like the Vice President of the Norwegian Parliament, Reiulf Steen, and some of the leading lawyers in Norway, which all of them have defended the newspapers in the court. But of course, a lot of people, among them also members of the Parliament, have the opinion that we have a press which has too much freedom and use its freedom to behave badly. Therefore, I suppose we have a long way to go before we reach our goal. As mentioned this morning, right now the trend is to take newspapers before the court. The problem from our point of view is that the judges use the cases to narrow the field of the free journalism instead of protecting the freedom of the press. The judges not only comment on what the press writes, but also the layout of the articles and where in the newspapers the articles are placed. The courts and the judges express too many general opinions rather than stick to the letter of the laws. It is too much thinking and feeling, as we say in Norway, rather than judicial valuation. Why the number of cases has arisen during the last 2 years is a very difficult question to give a precisely answer to. But it might be a connection between the number of cases and the general opinion among many peoples that we have newspapers which abuse their freedom and damage people's reputation and the number of cases. Of course, you always will have persons who want to go before the court to get some money. And in fact, many editors go into a compromise and in that way buy them free from the trouble it always are to be acting before the court. The problem is also that a lot of people mix the freedom of the press with the badly behaving of the same press. Therefore, the press has to fight at two fronts. First, to get the Freedom of the Press Act passed by the Parliament, and then to get the papers to behave more in accordance with the code of ethics. Since the ownership has been brought up, I will mention that in Norway, one of the biggest industrial corporations also has went into the newspaper business. In the southeastern part of Norway, a small county called Østfold, this corporation is the owner of the Keystone Industries and at the same time the owner of the biggest newspapers. In my opinion, this will be a problem for the press because, generally expressed, the sources cannot be the owners of the newspapers. The right of privacy are protected by the statute laws, but for the daily work in the editorial departments, the code of ethics are more interesting. I therefore want to draw the attention to paragraph 4 in our code of ethics, which are distributed among the delegates. I have to make my speech short, but let me just mention this. 2 weeks ago, a Norwegian aircraft crashed and 36 people, a lot of them from the same city, were killed. We are a very small country, and therefore the accident concerned all of us. But the question is how close the press shall go to expose the reactions among the people who are left behind and who want to mourn in privacy. I mention this because, in my opinion, one of the most difficult questions in the future will be to draw the line between the privacy and the public for people who have not placed themselves in the public, but is an offer or circumstances which draw public attention. In accordance with the Code of Ethics, we say that people who go into the public field, for instance, politicians, must accept critical and close-up covering by the papers. But if I am crying in my wife's funeral, who happened to be killed in an aircraft accident, which of course drew a lot of attention, public attention, has the press then the right to expose it to the Norwegian people? We are going to answer that question when we are back in Norway, since we have got a complaint from one other person who was left behind after the aircraft accident. Thank you.
Then next speech is made by Mr. Adelino Cardoso, Deputy of Press Council. Please.
Bom, esta nossa comunicação é a comunicação do Conselho de Imprensa de Portugal acerca deste tema. É, no fundo, o transmitir-vos a nossa falta de experiência relativamente a esta questão e falta de experiência que é compreensível se recordarem que nós temos apenas 13 anos de liberdade de imprensa e, portanto, todas estas questões são ainda entre nós, estão ainda pouco amadurecidas, porque a nossa prática é muito reduzida, ao contrário da prática de países que aqui estão presentes e que têm uma grande tradição de liberdade de imprensa e de leis que a protegem. Por isso mesmo, o problema da oposição entre o direito a informar e o direito à privacidade não tem assumido em Portugal aspectos conflituais significativos. E a opinião pública ainda não se consciencializou da gravidade de uma prática informativa ofensiva do direito à vida privada. Adiantaremos algumas explicações para esta falta de consciência social e profissional do problema, para a ausência de conflitos declarados e para a escassez de doutrina resultante de uma fraca experiência. Aos nossos colegas estrangeiros, não deixaremos de recordar que vivemos 40 anos de censura, a qual, devido à rigidez moral da filosofia política da ditadura, preocupada em manter uma aparência de moderação de costumes, exercia uma fiscalização puritana sobre o noticiário. De recordarmos que ainda só experimentamos 14 anos de liberdade de imprensa, um período de aprendizagem, quer para os jornalistas, quer para os consumidores da informação. Não admira, por isso, que a assunção de deveres deontológicos por parte de uns e de direitos cívicos por parte de outros se encontre ainda numa fase de conceptualização e de afinação da respectiva prática. Para além disto, um conjunto de outras circunstâncias pode ajudar a explicar porque é que o conflito entre o direito a informar e o direito à privacidade não constitui ainda um problema de dimensão pública em Portugal. Não existe em Portugal uma forte tradição de imprensa sensacionalista e só depois da instauração da democracia e com a liberdade de criação de empresas jornalísticas inexistente ou sujeita a apertado controle político durante a ditadura apareceram alguns jornais que desenvolveram esse tipo de jornalismo na procura de um mercado até então praticamente inexplorado. Ao contrário do que sucede noutros países europeus, essa imprensa sensacionalista e, em geral, a imprensa de grande circulação, não tem devassado de forma significativa a vida privada de homens públicos, políticos, grandes empresários, artistas populares, etc., o que teria contribuído para dar um maior relevo a qualquer possível transgressão. Esses jornais sensacionalistas devassam a vida privada de cidadãos das classes baixas, que não têm consciência dos seus direitos, nem capacidade de instrução para os exercer e para se defenderem. São quase sempre assuntos com origem em casos de polícia ou em julgamentos e dizem quase sempre respeito a crimes passionais, à violação de menores ou de casos associados ao consumo de droga, em casos mais restritos a crimes de imigrantes negros, num estilo racista que o Conselho de Imprensa recentemente condenou. É talvez por este conjunto de circunstâncias que o Conselho de Imprensa Português nunca recebeu nenhuma queixa de um cidadão por violação pelos jornais do direito à privacidade, que se encontra previsto na legislação portuguesa. Com efeito, o direito à reserva da vida privada familiar está consagrado como direito fundamental na Constituição da República Portuguesa e protegido na Lei Civil e Criminal. O Código Deontológico dos Jornalistas, aprovado pelo respectivo sindicato, estipula como dever dos profissionais da comunicação social, cito, não interferir na vida privada de qualquer cidadão, salvo quando ela tiver repercussão pública ou quando essa prática se impuser por motivos relevantes de interesse público. O facto do Conselho de Imprensa Português não ter recebido nunca qualquer queixa relativa à violação do direito à privacidade não impediu que se preocupasse com o problema, no sentido de não deixar que ele assumisse proporções indesejáveis e no sentido de consciencializar os editores para a necessidade de estabelecer um justo equilíbrio entre o respeito daquele direito e o exercício do direito a informar. Essa atitude do Conselho de Imprensa Português resulta de uma prática de intervenção, devemos assinalá-lo aos nossos colegas estrangeiros, que não se limita à recepção e tratamento das queixas. O Conselho de Imprensa Português tem decidido assumir uma posição ativa sobre questões de deontologia, de política estatal da informação, quer emitindo alguns pareceres doutrinários, quer pronunciando sobre legislação de imprensa, quer dialogando com órgãos do poder, seja o Governo, seja o Parlamento. Nesta linha de orientação, o Conselho de Imprensa Português tomou a iniciativa de chamar a si o problema da violação do direito à privacidade. O Conselho de Imprensa dedicou especial atenção ao noticiário dos denominados crimes contra a honestidade, ultraje público ao pudor, atentado ao pudor, estupro e violação, adultério, lenocídio e crimes contra a honra, e ao noticiário que envolve menores relativamente à prática de crimes ou a aspectos da sua vida familiar. Assim, repetidas vezes, o Conselho de Imprensa recomendou ao Sindicato dos Jornalistas, aos diretores e conselhos de redação dos jornais rádio e televisão, a necessidade do respeito por regras deontológicas, de modo a salvaguardar o bom nome e a integridade moral e social dos cidadãos. Essa intervenção sempre fez associar o problema do direito à privacidade com o do segredo de justiça, porque o primeiro é, em Portugal, genericamente violado em relação a cidadãos de classes baixas com origem em casos de polícia ou de tribunal. Passada a fase da recomendação aos meios de comunicação social, o Conselho de Imprensa decidiu apreciar, por sua iniciativa, alguns casos de infração ao direito à privacidade. Apurados alguns casos mais graves, deles deu conhecimento à Procuradoria-Geral da República, nomeadamente em casos de crime de atentado ao pudor ou violação sexual de menores. A Procuradoria-Geral da República é a instância do Estado a quem incumbiria, através do Ministério Público, processar judicialmente os órgãos de comunicação social cujas transgressões lhe foram apresentadas pelo Conselho de Imprensa. Não temos, no entanto, conhecimento de que qualquer processo judicial tenha sido desencadeado, o que parece revelar pouca preocupação da magistratura do Ministério Público pelo problema. Das várias posições e recomendações aprovadas pelo Conselho de Imprensa, destacamos os seguintes passos de uma datada de 1983. O Conselho de Imprensa vê com preocupação o aparecimento de jornais vocacionados pela exploração sensacionalista da privacidade dos cidadãos, sem respeito pelos direitos constitucional e penalmente protegidos das pessoas visadas, nem pelas normas do Código Deontológico dos Jornalistas. O Conselho de Imprensa chama a atenção para o dever dos órgãos de informação respeitarem o direito dos cidadãos ao bom nome, acautelando a sua integridade moral, tanto social como individualmente, e não dando antecipadamente como culpadas as pessoas suspeitas de qualquer ato passível de punição criminal, dificilmente reparável quanto aos danos na boa fama e bom nome dos visados. Num parecer da Procuradoria-Geral da República, que aliás foi solicitado pelo Conselho de Imprensa, concluía-se a este respeito: a proteção da intimidade da vida privada das pessoas envolvidas nos processos criminais, incluindo vítimas, queixosos e ofendidos, encontra limitações ou limites nas exigências da polícia e da justiça, mesmo naqueles casos específicos em que a lei, de forma expressa, impõe um segredo de justiça absoluto, como no processo tutelar e naqueles em que proíbe a narração de certos comportamentos antissociais de menores. Este parecer, que acabo de citar, fala apenas de exigências da investigação policial e da administração da justiça. Mas o Conselho de Imprensa Portuguesa entende que pode haver exigências do direito da imprensa a informar e do público a ser informado em certas circunstâncias que limitem o direito à privacidade. Ao analisar por sua iniciativa um caso de violação de privacidade, o Conselho de Imprensa fez doutrina sobre esses limites. Transcrevo. Em certos casos, em determinadas circunstâncias, é lícito restringir o direito à intimidade e a expandir correspondentemente o direito à informação. Noutros, que serão a generalidade, o direito à informação acaba ali, onde se levanta o muro da privacidade. Da conjugação harmónica dos dois direitos em causa, resulta ser lícito divulgar factos da vida privada quando o próprio nisso consentir. Quando tais factos sejam notórios e, por isso, percam o seu caráter íntimo, ou ainda quando haja um interesse legítimo do público no seu conhecimento. O interesse legítimo do público no conhecimento de factos da vida privada pode decorrer da circunstância de as pessoas a que eles respeitam participarem acidentalmente na história contemporânea, por exemplo, por terem tomado parte de um facto da atualidade, ou pode decorrer de as pessoas a que eles respeitam serem personagens dessa história, ou porque são candidatos ou exercem cargos sujeitos à eleição, ou porque exercem atividades públicas que lhes conferem notoriedade. É o caso, entre outros, dos artistas, atores, desportistas, políticos, etc. Mas o interesse público não legitima que se noticiem todos e quaisquer factos da vida íntima das pessoas públicas. Por um lado, há de haver um conjunto de factos que deve ser em absoluto inacessível, sem o que a liberdade de imprensa esmagaria totalmente o direito à intimidade. Por outro, os factos a divulgar devem ser os adequados à informação pertinente à notoriedade das pessoas em causa e com relação útil, do ponto de vista do direito à informação, com os cargos e as atividades públicas que desempenham. Assim, por exemplo, será lícito noticiar os eventos relativos à vida íntima de um candidato a um lugar elegível que devam ser ponderados pelo eleitor por influenciarem ou deverem influenciar a sua escolha. Mas já não é legítimo noticiar factos que não tenham relação ou não sejam pertinentes à escolha que é proposta ao público ou ao eleitorado. Sejam quais forem as dificuldades que surjam na delimitação do conjunto dos acontecimentos, que preencham o conteúdo do direito à privacidade, sempre nele se hão de incluir, pelo menos, os relativos à vida afetiva e à vida familiar. Deve ainda sublinhar-se que o direito à privacidade perdura para além da morte, prolonga-se na memória dos familiares e dos amigos, juridicamente transmite-se aos herdeiros. Fim de citação do documento doutrinário do Conselho de Imprensa. Este parecer do Conselho de Imprensa português, emitido há 2 meses, fora motivado pela apreciação de uma reportagem em que era devassada a vida amorosa de um padre e de uma jovem a propósito de um acidente de que resultou a morte dela quando ambos tomavam banho. Sendo Portugal um país fortemente católico, e no caso concreto tratando-se de um facto ocorrido numa pequena aldeia, o Conselho de Imprensa não deixou de abordar e de ter em conta outras questões. Assim, e admitindo que se tivesse querido pôr em causa a contradição entre a doutrina moral da Igreja Católica e a prática de um seu apóstolo qualificado, o Conselho de Imprensa entendeu que a reportagem haveria de ser escrita noutros termos e sempre salvaguardando a privacidade das pessoas envolvidas. Por outro lado, e tendo em conta a realidade portuguesa, o Conselho de Imprensa estendeu um pouco o âmbito do direito à privacidade, considerando que, nesta situação, ou neste caso, não é só a vida privada das pessoas envolvidas que é atingida, mas a pequena comunidade de que eram filhos e de que faziam parte. No entendimento de que uma reportagem crua e impúdica como a que foi publicada pode ter ferido a honra da comunidade em relação ao exterior e as relações dos seus membros entre si. Concluindo, vou acabar, diremos que se o fenómeno da ofensa do direito à privacidade pelos órgãos de comunicação social não atingiu ainda em Portugal uma dimensão preocupante, deve, no entanto, estar o Conselho de Imprensa atento ao seu desenvolvimento, porque é previsível que venha a agravar-se. Por um lado, devido à crise económica da imprensa escrita, que por vezes dela se defende pela via do sensacionalismo. Por outro lado, e caso mais peculiar português, porque vai assistir-se em Portugal a uma maior concorrência no mercado, depois da futura e breve reprivatização dos jornais diários estatizados, que são dos mais importantes, de maior expansão e tiragem do país.
Introduced the first woman among this, the speakers, Margareta Arve, Deputy Press Ombudsman for the general public.
Very nice, thank you. Can you hear me? Is this the right distance? All right. I shall indeed try to be brief. We have in fact submitted documentation, minute of this speech, the Code of Ethics and the annual survey of 1987 with instances of censures made by the Press Council, and I will refer you to this. And I will only try to pick out some points which are perhaps of particular interest regarding the previous speeches. Our Norwegian friends have very kindly referred to the Freedom of the Press Act of Sweden as being something desirable. Of course, the essential thing is that this act forbids public censorship and forbids the authorities to try to make any obstacles in the way of a person who wants to publish a newspaper. But I think perhaps what is specific for the Swedish system and more interesting are two sets of rules who aim to protect the supply of information, the obtaining of information. First, there is this sunshine principle which we talk about and which Mr. Kiel talked about as being recently introduced in Denmark. The fact that any document kept in the files of public authorities is accessible to each and everyone, not only to the press, mark you, but to each and everyone. So you can walk into the state or municipal agencies and ask to be shown the documents there. And the official cannot deny you this right unless they give you a written decision and has a right to appeal this decision so it can be discussed further. You need not give your name, and you need not tell the reason why you want to see this document. This, of course, is very important to enable the press to really look into the affairs of the public authorities. Of course, there are exceptions to these rules, and they are contained in the Official Secrets Act, and the principle is that the documents are public, and unless they're listed explicitly in the Official Secrets Act, they are public, by definition. That's important, I think. It means the authorities have to sort of plead their cause if they want to keep the documents secret. However, it's also important to protect the right to supply information to the press, and we have a very strong protection for the individual who supplies information to the press. Anyone has the right to give information on any subject, even if he has an official position. A civil servant, for instance, can give information to the press quite freely. He may not always be allowed to hand out the document itself, but he may be able to relate the contents of the document. And he may be anonymous, I would say to 99%. The reporter in Sweden not only has the right not to disclose his sources, he is compelled by law, in fact by the Freedom of the Press Act, not to do so, and can be punished if he does. There is a penal provision in the Freedom of the Press Act for anyone employed by a newspaper, anyone, to give out the identity of a source without its consent. There are a few exceptions. They're so subtle, I won't go into them. Mr. Nudlin would answer any questions if you refer to those exceptions. However, even if you should give your name, I mean, even if you should voluntarily give your name, you write an article, you write a letter to the editor, you are interviewed in the paper, you can say anything. And you cannot be held responsible for it. You can be as slanderous as you like about the Prime Minister. You can call him a pervert, an alcoholic, a criminal, and a traitor. And you cannot be held responsible. Because there's only one person responsible for what is printed in the paper. It's like in Italy, we have a responsible editor for each paper. And this is a responsible editor who has to take the charges and go to jail, if so should be the case, which never happens.